Our psalm today, it's a prayer to God for help. So verse 7, the psalmist pleads for God to come out of his home, Zion, and restore his people. And from verse 6, we know the source of the psalmist's troubles is injustice. Evildoers who frustrate the plans of the poor, when the people with power mistreat and oppress the vulnerable. And the mistreated are powerless to fend for themselves except to run away and find refuge in God. Like from time to time, we still hear about people who take refuge in churches. Verse 4 says the powerless are eaten up like bread. They're easy prey because they're completely defenseless. So this gives us the context of the fool in verse 1, who is the source of the psalmist's pain. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. Now, the psalmist is not really talking about people who don't believe God exists. There's really no such thing as an atheist in this part of the world at that time. Even though atheism did start around the time when the psalm prayer book was compiled. But atheism started in Asia, in China and India, when Buddhists and Hindus shifted focus from their meditation, from supreme beings to nature. And it would be another 1,000 years before philosophers drilled down to explore that topic. So the psalmist's beef is not with atheists exactly. The psalmist is thinking about a particular kind of foolish. It's the people who know there's a God or gods, but live like they're not accountable for the way they conduct themselves in their lives. The fool here is the one who's been privileged with power, but is using his power to make life miserable for people less powerful because he thinks he can get away with it. And all the warnings about divine judgment and accountability for people who do evil are just empty threats. So the psalmist is complaining to God about the fool, who is the source of his suffering. What makes the fool foolish is not just his abusive use of power and him choosing to be that kind of person in the world, and his callousness to the damage he's doing to other people. What makes this person a fool is also his cockiness, treating God as the toothless old man who is unaware or can do nothing about the wrong that he sees. When God not only sees everything the fool does, but the fool would one day have to answer to God for the wrong he's done. He's a fool because he's not taking God seriously. He's foolish to think he can carry on the way he does and there would not be consequences. And verse 5 says they fail to anticipate the dread that is coming because God stands with the oppressed and mistreated. The message translates this as a dread that is coming, something in the future. But in the NIV, there's the sense that the dread is already here. But the fool, being a fool, is missing all the warning signs. Now, the fool is a popular theme in the Old Testament. So Job talks about the divine consequences for the foolish in 5:2. I myself, he says, have seen a fool taking root, but suddenly his house was cursed. His children are far from safety. Proverbs 1:7 says, respect of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. So in other words, it's foolish to ignore God and not take God seriously. And Proverbs 12:15 says, the way of the fool seems right to them, but the wise listens to advice. That it is foolish to think that we are the final authority of us. So in Psalm 14, having established the thesis statement that it is foolish to live like God doesn't matter, the psalmist now paints the picture of a world overrun by fools. There is no one who does good, he says, verse 1. And then he says it again. But this time he ups the ante on his claim that there is no good person. So in verse 2, he brings us into heaven with God standing in front of some sort of control panel with CCTV monitors. And we follow God's gaze as he scans down at the monitors, apparently looking for a good person, who takes the road not taken by fools and seeks to bless rather than to destroy. And the psalmist has God shaking his head in despair. And he puts these words into God's mouth. All have turned away. All have become corrupt. So then, as if we got agreeing with him about the sad lot of the world, he says again, there's no one who does good. Not even one. So, do you agree with that? Do you agree with the psalmist? That there's no one who does good in the world? Not even one? It's not hard to imagine when the Psalms were collected into a prayer book, the few hundred years before Jesus, when ancient Israel was in exile or just coming out of exile, that life for the psalmist really did feel that grim. When Israel had been invaded by an empire, the nation gutted by a superpower, and their citizens had been captured and dispersed through the foreign empire as slaves. So this psalm gave them the words to cry out to God as their refuge when life was unbearably tough. These words helped them verbalize their pain and to beg for God to come and rescue them and restore them as a nation. And these words describe their dread as they prayed their sadness and powerlessness that there's no one who does good. It may or may not be factually true that God cannot find a single person who does good on earth then or now, because that doesn't really square with my observations of the world. I know some very kind and generous people, and I'm looking at some of you. So to say there's no one who does good sounds like hyperbole. That is a poet using exaggerated language to make a point. So perhaps the point is not really that there's no one who does good, but that in the moment of great suffering, from the point of view of the people who are in pain at the hands of ruthless overlords standing over them, when there's no one coming to the rescue, when there's no help coming, then it certainly feels like there's no one who does good. I think about that lady in Langley who recently lost her husband in the heat wave. She had called the ambulance when her husband collapsed from a heat stroke. Except she waited and waited and no one came because the paramedics were overwhelmed with distress calls. To add to her frustration, she only lived 10 minutes away from the hospital. But she could not physically lift her husband into the car by herself, and there was no one around to help her. The ambulance finally came 90 minutes later. They did the best they could, but it was too late. I can imagine if it's me during that desperate 90 minutes, feeling all alone and wondering why help has not come, it would feel like there's no one who does good in the world. There was a story last week about a couple in China whose little boy was kidnapped 24 years ago. He was playing by the door of their house while the mom was cooking dinner just inside the door. Apparently, 70,000 kids go missing a year in China, where evil doing people would take the little boys and girls and traffic them across the country and sell the kids to couples who can't have children. So this dad spent 24 years riding a motorcycle cross country looking for his boy. 24 years on a mission by himself with not much help from the authorities. 24 years of asking, where are the people who have information that can steer me to get my son back? Did he think, while he was on his bike by himself, miles after miles, the world is so full of bad people. There's no one who does good. Well, last week, the police notified him without much explanation. They have found someone who might be his son. One news report says that the police used the computer to predict what the two-year-old would look like now and fit that picture into their massive surveillance system and found a possible match. they have arrested a woman who took the toddler and a man who sold him. And a DNA test has confirmed that a young school teacher is indeed the lost son. And as you can imagine, it was a very emotional reunion. The depressing truth is that it takes no work at all to make the case that the world is full of evildoers. They're Nazis and colonizers and slavers and despots. And with social media, it's unrelenting. The onslaught of bad news coming at us, that honestly, to just make a list in one sitting of the awful news from just the past few months would leave us on the floor curled up in a fetal position crying uncle. So yes, the world is full of evildoers. And at times, it really does feel like there's no one who does good. Who do you know might be feeling like that at this moment? That they're so alone in their pain that they feel like there's no good in the world and there's no one good in the world. And do you find that when you listen to someone say this, that you're able to hear them? And you can understand why they may feel this way? And you get why they may even doubt if God is really good, if God is really a safe refuge and is with them in the ditch. What the psalmist did not know when he wrote the psalm, or the scribes when they put the psalm into the prayer book, is that when the psalmist says in verse 5, God is in the company of the suffering people, that God actually would come in person into the world to physically keep company with suffering people. What the psalmist could not have imagined is that God's solution to the problem of evil in the world would involve Jesus as the Son of God coming into the world in person. And what might surprise the psalmist was that God's solution to the evil use of power was not to overpower the evildoers, that God preferred not to fight fire with fire. Instead, Jesus submitted to injustice. He let evildoers kill him and then rose from the dead to show that injustice does not have dominion, that the fools don't have the kind of power they think they have. Jesus' life, his death, and his resurrection began the process of God reclaiming the universe he made, together with people who would follow Jesus by living the way of love. God's solution to the perception of a world lacking in people who do good is to dispatch its people to bring hope and light through tangible blessings to people feeling alone in their suffering. 9/11 was a particularly dark day. Do you remember where you were, what you were doing when you heard America was under attack? I had just gotten up when my aunt called in tears telling us to turn on our TV. I didn't even know what I was watching as I tried to make sense of the smoke coming out of one of the towers. And then I saw the second plane hit the second tower. And I felt the wind knock out of me because 3 months earlier, we had all been in New York to visit with relatives. And what I felt didn't even come close to all the people who had family working in the towers or living in the neighborhood. My sister had a friend who was in one of the towers that morning for a meeting. And my sister spent all day trying to get her friend on the phone, but couldn't get through. And then there were all the people on a flight into the States when the airspace was closed and their families had no idea where their loved ones got to. Well, 6,700 of them on 38 airliners ended up in Gander, Newfoundland. That's almost as many people who lived in that little town. When the planes touched down, the passengers were not allowed to deplane, because the authorities were still trying to figure out what was going on and who was doing it. And the people in Gander took a beat to assess the possibility that they might have had terrorists sitting on the tarmac. Because in that moment, it felt like the world was full of bad people. So the passengers sat in the plane for something like 8 hours. They didn't know what was going on because the authorities also decided to keep them in the dark to avoid panic. But then word was beginning to spread from people with cell phones that America had been attacked. On this, one of the darkest days in human history, you remember what happened? The town folk of Gander made a decision to overcome evil with good, and they sprang into action. When one of the passengers saw a caravan of headlights from buses coming towards the plane, he suddenly realized that while he was plying himself with drinks to stay calm, trapped on the plane, the town was planning and organizing schools and churches into temporary shelters. And for the next 6 days, 300 volunteers worked around the clock to feed and house and clothe the strangers. They gathered up all the fresh food they could find from nearby towns and across the bay and turned the ice rink into a huge refrigerator. They bought all the clothes and underwear at the Walmart. They set up phone banks and hotlines and a cable news channel to spread the word whenever somebody needed something, like when some of the visitors wanted to try eating moose. And people emptied all their freezers of moose. Or like when one of the schools ran out of toilet paper, so they went on air with the request and then had to go on air again to tell people they could stop sending toilet paper because they now have a few years supply of it and nowhere to put it. But more than just the necessities, they had dances and parties and excursions because the town folk recognized there were deep needs in the soul that also need attending to. One of the passengers said the Ganderites executed kindness with military precision. When the planes were allowed to fly again, one passenger thanked one of the volunteers and in tears said, "I don't know how to explain to people back home that I came here as a refugee, but I'm coming home with a tan and 5 pounds heavier." He said what another passenger expressed, that he didn't want to go home. He said, "I was taken off the treadmill of life and dropped off in heaven and was looked after by angels." This is the task Jesus entrusted to us with the help of the Spirit, that while we wait for him to return, as we live as God's people in a world that sometimes feels overrun with evil, that we are to keep doing what Jesus did when he was here with us, to make blessings in the world, especially where it's the darkest, where people suffer alone, convinced there's no good left in the world. We make blessings not just because blessings are needed in the world, but it's also our best protection from being sucked into despair. When we make blessings, we get in on what God is doing and get to see him work up close. And our own hope in God is bolstered. Like the teacher in Gander who said over those days, she was glad she was so busy, she didn't have time to think about what was happening in the world. Her keeping busy helping people kept her from being dragged into an emotional pit. That man in China who lost his son 24 years ago, while he was searching for his son, he also started a foundation that helped other parents find their kidnapped children. So I don't think it's true that there's no one who does good in the world. Many people of many religions or no religions do a lot of good. But as Christians, doing good is what God entrusts us to. In between Jesus' coming, because God is good, God does good, and that's the family business. And us creating blessing in our weekday lives are the puzzle pieces that fit together into the big picture of what God is doing to remake the world into his original idea of it when he made it and us in it. And making blessing is how we follow in Jesus' footsteps in countering evil in the world. And it's us preparing the world for when Jesus comes back and bringing heaven with him to come on earth. When the fire chief in Gander heard that there were Make-A-Wish kids on the way to Disneyland and were now stuck in Gander with them, they decided to throw a birthday party for all the kids. one of the ladies was asked to come dress as the mascot of their local hockey team, Captain Gander, a giant fluffy costume that looks half duck and half penguin. She was a bit hesitant at first because she didn't know how Captain Gander could possibly compete with Mickey Mouse. But when Captain Gander showed up, the kids went nuts. When the party was over, the mother of one of the sick kids told the chief, "Actually, it's fine we didn't get to go to Disneyland. This was better." Imagine that. That Gander managed to out-happy what is advertised as the happiest place on earth. The more despairing we find in the world, the more we are reminded that Jesus taught us to soothe the world by being salt and light with the help of God's Spirit. And when it comes together, the result is better than even Disneyland. Because more than a temporary diversion, God through us channels blessing into real life, real people, through real friendship where it counts, beginning now through eternity. So here's 1 Peter 3, verse 8. "All of you, be like-minded. Be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing. Because to this you were called, so that you may inherit the blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil and their lips from deceitful speech. They must turn from evil and do good. They must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to the prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." So let me give you a moment to begin a conversation with God. And then I will read you Malcolm Guite's version of Psalm 14. Take a moment. Here's Malcolm Guite's Psalm 14. "When heaven's hidden gates are drawn apart and our captivity is ended, we'll rejoice. But now the fool's in charge, and in his heart he only echoes his own emptiness. No God, no vestiges of reverence disturb his vanity. Just weariness and mockery. Just cruel insolence and greed that still consumes the poor like bread. These only seem to move him. Violence is like a drug to him. He cocks his head and speaks his poison words with hissing tongue, and yet we still believe in him. Yet we still believe him. Let him dread the day that's coming. It will not be long. The poor have cried, and now they have heard. The fool will fall before the joyful song." Amen.